From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Chevron under fire. A Congress member calls for hearings on the oil giant's role in the killing of villagers in the Niger Delta. Also, will Chevron succeed in getting the Securities and Exchange Commission to kill a shareholder resolution holding the company accountable? And students protest around the country in an effort to keep sweatshop products out of their schools. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. fighter jets fired on at least five Iraqi targets in the northern no-fly zone today, including two communication sites and a surface-to-air missile system, this according to the Pentagon. Yesterday, U.S. jets bombed defense sites in the southern no-fly zone near the town of Mosul. The official Iraqi news agency reported yesterday that one civilian was killed and an unknown number of others were hurt in the airstrikes. It's the second consecutive day that U.S. forces have slammed Iraqi defense systems in the U.S.-British fly zones. Senators will close the doors for a third and possibly final time today, deliberating the articles of impeachment against President Clinton. Republican leaders want to reach a verdict by the end of the day, but the final votes might not come until tomorrow. Only about half the senators have spoken so far. Clinton is accused of perjury and obstruction of justice. Senators are confident neither impeachment count will receive the 67 votes needed to remove him from office. The only drama left is whether the obstruction of justice charge might win more than 50 votes. Yesterday, three Republicans announced they will not vote to convict. All three, James Jeffords of Vermont, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, and John Chafee of Rhode Island, say their decision is not vindication for Clinton. Meanwhile, Connecticut Democrat Joseph Lieberman says if the GOP does stop efforts to force a censure vote, supporters might just draft a declaration condemning the president's behavior and circulate it for senators to sign. American Airlines says flyers can expect more travel snags today, even though a judge has ordered pilots to end their sick out against the company. An airline spokesperson says it'll take a couple days to get American back on its feet. More than 2,500 flights have been canceled since Saturday, stranding more than 200,000 travelers. A federal judge in Dallas ordered pilots back into their cockpits yesterday, but he also had angry words for the airline. He said if you looked up bad labor relations in the dictionary, there would be, quote, an American Airlines logo beside it. This news from Jakarta. The Indonesian dictator B.J. Habibie said today he wants the issue of East Timor resolved by the start of next year. His comments come a day after East Timorese rebel leader Xanana Gusmao was moved from prison to house arrest. Most expect Gusmao to lead the impoverished country if it does eventually become independent. Many world leaders have called for Xanana Gusmao to be released without condition. Signaling a possible change of its interrogation methods, the Shin Bet Security Service of Israel this week covered detainees' eyes only with dark sunglasses rather than the customary urine-drenched hoods, this according to a lawyer today. The lawyer, Tamar Peleg, said a client informed her of the new practice. She said she also caught a glimpse of another detainee wearing the oversized glasses in a Shin Bet lockup. Israel's Supreme Court has been hearing an appeal against Shin Bet interrogation methods by human rights groups and several Palestinian security detainees. Petitioners say the Shin Bet practices constitute torture and must be declared illegal. According to court testimony in Jerusalem, detainees are tied up on low chairs with smelly hoods placed over their heads during long interrogation sessions. While sitting in the so-called Shabbat position, they are blasted with loud music and deprived of sleep for days at a time. This news from New York. The father of an African immigrant shot by New York police is calling for justice. Amadou Diallo's father has arrived in New York to retrieve his son's body. Diallo died a week ago today after he was hit by 19 of the 41 bullets fired at him by four white police officers. An attorney says the officers fired because they thought he was reaching for a gun, but only his wallet and a beeper were found nearby. New York City's police commissioner plans to meet today with a city council panel to discuss the shooting. Already, the shooting has prompted the police department to order refresher training in police tactics for its elite street crime unit. Its motto is, "We own the night." Less than a day after Georgia became the first state to shield gun makers from product liability lawsuits by cities and counties, Louisiana's governor said he supports such a ban. Governor Mike Foster today threw his backing behind a bill that would block a New Orleans lawsuit seeking damages from gun manufacturers for the costs of gun violence. The bill Georgia Governor Roy Barnes signed Tuesday was meant to block a similar case by Atlanta. And Philip Morris was assessed $50 million in punitive damages stemming from a suit by an ex-smoker with lung cancer. A day earlier, the San Francisco jury awarded the plaintiff $1.5 million in compensatory damages. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The recent wave of repression and violence by the Nigerian military in the Niger Delta has left scores of villagers dead and has sparked worldwide attention, as has the role of oil companies such as Royal Dutch Shell and the U.S. multinational corporation Chevron in the killing of villagers. Late last month, around 19 people were killed by the military as they protested outside a Shell terminal. And on January 4th, activists from the Niger Delta reported that once again, Chevron flew in the military, which killed at least two people. As Democracy Now! Reported in its expose, Drilling and Killing, companies such as Chevron have leased helicopters and paid the Nigerian military to repress communities seeking justice and an end to the environmental devastation of their land. Well, after hearing about these killings, a U.S. Congress member is now pressing for hearings to determine the precise role that U.S. multinationals play in facilitating and encouraging human rights violations in the countries they operate in. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, who is a Democrat from Ohio, has circulated a Dear Colleague letter on Capitol Hill, which begins by saying, quote, "I urge you to invite a congressional investigation into the allegations of killings of innocent civilians, human rights abuses, and harassment of environmental activists by the Nigerian security forces in collaboration with U.S. multinational oil corporations in the Niger Delta in recent weeks." Also, some of Chevron's shareholders have introduced a shareholders resolution, holding the company accountable for its participation in human rights abuses. Chevron is currently lobbying the Securities and Exchange Commission to have the bill killed. We're joined right now by two people. Simon Billingus is with us with Franklin Research, a socially conscious investment firm in Boston, and Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. Congressmember Kucinich, can you start just by telling us what this Dear Colleague letter is about?
Yes, I'm letting members of Congress know what's going on in Nigeria with respect to the actions of Chevron providing helicopters, boats, and other hardware which the Nigerian security forces use to ferry troops to villages where innocent civilians were massacred. And this is a matter which cries out for justice. And when you have oil companies that are in the business of not only ruining the environment, but violating human rights and participating in extrajudicial killings, it's time that, through their acceptance of them, it's time for the United States to actively intervene.
What exactly are you calling for in the Congress?
Well, you know, first of all, we absolutely have to have a congressional investigation into the U.S. oil company complicity in the murders of innocent civilians. We have to make sure that our oil companies are not buying oil at the price of human lives, human rights, and democracy. And so I'm looking for a very broad probe into this because it is absolutely fundamental that we should support the people of Nigeria in their efforts to have a decent quality of life, to be able to be free of ecological disaster, and to be free of the fear of violence against them, and to be free of being annihilated by a military which is backed by U.S. oil interests.
Have you had any dialogue with the oil companies, in particular Chevron? It is the largest corporation that's headquartered in California.
I think the appropriate place to have a dialogue with Chevron is where when their officials are under oath. And I think that would be the appropriate place to have a dialogue with them.
In addition to Congressmember Kucinich, we're joined by Simon Bilanis of Franklin Research in Boston. Simon, your group has introduced a Chevron shareholder resolution. Can you explain what it is?
Certainly. Franklin Research and Development in Boston, where I work, we're a socially responsible investment firm, and we manage money for religious institutions, trade unions, and progressive individuals. So what we've done is we introduced a resolution at Chevron specifically raising the whole issue of not only the recent killings of demonstrators at Chevron facilities in Nigeria, but specifically asking Chevron to ensure that when they operate in communities around the world, that they operate in accordance with respect for the environment and respect for human rights. This resolution was joined in by not only a number of our own shareholders, but also a number of religious institutions around the country, both Protestant and Catholic. And we're hoping that the resolution will come up at Chevron's annual meeting. We'll have a chance to debate it. We'll have a chance to ask questions of Chevron's top management. And in the same way that Representative Kucinich is trying to pursue this issue through congressional hearings, get these companies accountable for what's happening in Nigeria.
What is the process you have to go through to have this shareholder resolution actually voted on at the annual meeting? Has it been approved? Is it going to be at the meeting?
It's relatively straightforward to file a resolution, since you only need to hold $2,000 worth of a company's shares, and that's relatively straightforward. But we do face one obstacle, and that is the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates shareholder resolutions, has received a request from Chevron to exclude the shareholder resolution from Chevron's annual meeting. And so we're hoping that the Securities and Exchange Commission particularly will see that this issue is new, is developing. There's a lot of interest in Congress, led by Representative Kucinich in this, and that they'll allow the shareholder resolution to come to a vote.
Well, I can also say that my office will be sending a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission asking them to support the position of the socially responsible investors.
Does the Securities and Exchange Commission respond to Congressmembers' pressure? I mean, would this make a big difference?
Well, I can say that I don't know, but I can tell you this, that I just became the ranking Democrat on the regulatory subcommittee, which has jurisdiction over the Securities and Exchange Commission. So perhaps they'll be responsive to a letter. If not, I'll be seeing them in front of a committee enough times to find out why not.
And certainly the SEC in the past has been responsive to congressional pressure, particularly a couple of years ago when they tried to restrict the ability of shareholders to bring resolutions on environmental and human rights issues. So I think with Representative Kucinich and others putting pressure on the SEC in this way, and if people also call the SEC and write letters as well, I think this could have a very powerful effect on the SEC and may well lead them to allowing the shareholder resolution remain on the ballot.
Is it Chevron that is trying to kill the shareholder resolution at the SEC?
Yeah, Chevron is the only one. A similar resolution has also been filed at Texaco, but Texaco has not challenged it at the SEC, and they've agreed to meet with shareholders to discuss this issue, which is a useful step forward. Chevron, by contrast, has completely stonewalled, and so that's why I'm very much welcome this interest amongst members in Congress, because I think this will help force Chevron to actually come to the table and make themselves accountable on this issue.
Yes, so this is Congressman Kucinich. I feel this is an extremely important issue because what Chevron is doing is using the military in order to conduct an assault on villagers who are protesting their environmental policies and the economic policies that are adverse to the interests of the people. And, you know, it wasn't only over the, you know, there have been unarmed residents who have been killed by government troops with the complicity of this oil company. And I've, you know, they may say that they've had nothing to do with it and they can't have any control over what's happening. But the fact is
that there are instances where Chevron actually provided the helicopters, the boats, and the hardware. You know, there was an incident on which was confirmed on January 4th, 1999. There was an incident that was the subject of a Pacifica radio investigative report that I believe happened in May of last year. Chevron's attitude is that life is cheap in Nigeria. You know, granted, they have a gross domestic product that is, you know, one of the lower ones in the world, of a few hundred dollars a year per capita. But Chevron is using the military to protect its oil activities. They're engaging in human rights abuses, and you know, their advocates and their associates in Nigeria see this. They don't see this as a moral issue. This is just commercial. This is just business. Well, life isn't cheap. It's not just business. This is about human rights. And whether it's the poor in this country or the poor in Nigeria, we have a moral obligation to make sure that people's lives are not being sacrificed to the profit interest of a huge international corporation. So I'm going to take this issue to the Congress and bring the attention of the Congress to it, and let Chevron know that this conduct on their part is not acceptable anywhere in the world.
We are talking to Cleveland Congressmember Dennis Kucinich from Ohio, as well as Simon Bilanis, who is with Franklin Research, that has introduced a shareholder resolution that they hope to vote on at the Chevron annual meeting if the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, allows this resolution to stand. And we're going to get the phone number of the SEC so you can help participate in SEC making a decision on this. But before we do that, I wanted to ask Congressmember Kucinich, when Jeremy Scahill and I went to Nigeria in September and August of this year and learned of this story of Chevron this past May flying in the feared mobile police known as the Kill and Go in Nigeria and the notorious Nigerian Navy, we went to the U.S. Embassy in Lagos and we asked them what the approach of the U.S. Embassy was. They said it was to promote U.S. business abroad, that overall that is the role of any U.S. embassy abroad. We also went to Chevron headquarters in Lagos, and on tape, the Chevron spokesperson said, and Chevron Corporation San Francisco said he was speaking for the corporation based here. He said, yes, we flew in the Navy. We flew in the mobile police. It was Chevron's management that authorized this. And what resulted on May 28th of last year was two Nigerian villagers killed, one critically wounded. In fact, I'll play the words of Shola Mole, the Chevron spokesperson in Nigeria, in this startling admission to Democracy Now.
Who took them in?
What's that?
Who took them in? On Thursday morning, the mobile police, the Navy?
We did. The Chevron did. We took them there.
By how?
Helicopters, yes. We took them in.
Who authorized the call for the military to come in?
That's Chevron's management.
Again, a Chevron spokesperson in Nigeria saying Chevron's management authorized the call for the military to come in last May 28th and admitting that Chevron flew in the military. We may have also seen this repeated on January 4th. Reports out of the Delta suggest that Chevron once again flew in the military into two villages, and the numbers of fatalities may have been worse. Congressmember Kucinich, what responsibility does the U.S. government have in all of this?
Well, the U.S. government has a responsibility for this because we are buying the oil. And I think that it would be an interesting test to have Chevron's officials held responsible for the murders that were conducted with their equipment, with their planes, and with their other materiel. You know, in the United States, at law, that's if someone uses your car to commit a crime and you know it, you're an accessory. And, you know, certainly there has to be some connection with that principle. In addition to that, these are international laws at stake here, too. In addition to that, we ought to be looking at promoting sanctions against Chevron. Because I think sanctions would give them the message that this is not going to be accepted. I don't think this. There isn't even a debate about this. It's very clear. Chevron admits permitting their material to be used, and they have a different view of this. The United States has a responsibility to step in, and it has a responsibility not only to impose oil sanctions, but to seek prosecution of those officials who were involved in the decision which resulted in the death of innocent civilians in Nigeria.
Well, in terms of action that people can take, Simon Billinis, do you have a phone number people can call at the Securities and Exchange Commission where Chevron is trying to block your shareholder resolution?
Certainly. I have a phone number here and a web page. People can call up the Securities and Exchange Commission at area code 202-942-4150. That's 202-942-4150. Their website is quite simply www.sec.gov. And send a letter to the chairman of the SEC, Arthur Levitt, and specifically urge them to ensure that the shareholder resolution on Nigeria at Chevron this year stays on the company's ballot.
We're talking with Simon Billinis of Franklin Research, a socially conscious investment firm in Boston, as well as Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we are talking to Simon Billinis, who is with Franklin Research, a socially conscious investment firm, as well as Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. Congressmember, while you're the ranking Democrat on the relevant committee that would oversee the SEC and that deals with companies like Chevron Corporation, realistically, as a Democrat in a Republican-controlled House, what is the chance that you could get a House investigation of the oil corporations in Nigeria?
Well, whether we get an investigation or not, this issue is not going to go away. I'm hopeful that some of my colleagues, when they learn the full story here, will be shocked enough to want to participate. You know, this we should have known a few years ago with the execution of Ken Sarowiwa and other Ogoni activists that this was not this human rights abuse will not stop until we put some economic controls on the oil companies. And the only way to do that is to have sanctions. And so if it fails before the Congress in terms of investigations, then we've got to, and I will insist on putting pressure for sanctions against the Nigerian regime. And it's not enough to say that they're in transition. It's Chevron that's the problem here, because they're letting the Nigerian regime use their equipment and use their helicopters and their boats and other hardware to move troops around, and those troops are then massacring civilians.
Congressmember Kucinich, we've tried to get Chevron on our radio program since the documentary, though they did speak and actually admit to their complicity at the time. They now, while they won't join us, they did send us a press release that said because they are in a joint venture with the Nigerian military regime, they do what they're told. It's 60% Nigerian military, 40% Chevron. What is your response to that?
You're absolutely right. They are in a joint venture. And the venture is called murder. And when you are complicit in activities which result in people being killed, you ought to be held responsible in a court of law. And that's what we're also researching right now. This is the same kind of issue that is being brought up with respect to the activities of the unlamented General Pinochet. And I think we need to pursue broad international pressure to defend these innocent villagers, these helpless villagers in Nigeria. People who don't even raise so much as a placard are getting gunned down. And whether it's two people or 200, and the number is already mounting into the several hundreds, we need to speak as a nation which has revered principles of justice for all. We need to speak on behalf of those people whose lives are being sacrificed because of this policy which we have maintained a silence on, of the Chevron Oil Company in Nigeria.
Apparently, Jesse Jackson, as an emissary of President Clinton, will be going to Nigeria. The presidential elections will be held very soon, later this February. And apparently, he'll be going to the Delta because this has caused a lot of concern, the protests in the Delta, for the oil corporations because they're losing money. Is there some message you have to President Clinton about what should be done in the U.S. government's name at this point? Also, apparently, President Carter just returned from Nigeria, where he met with the Chevron Corporation.
Well, you know, first of all, everyone is interested in the transfer to civilian rule. We know it's been postponed. You have to look at the history here, and we don't know that the oil companies are not going to do what they can to block the interest of democratic rights from succeeding. I think that with oil prices so low, it's going to be particularly hard to be able to put together any transition program for economic reform. And I think that the lack of a humane and human rights policy on the part of the oil companies, in this case Chevron, virtually guarantees that any civilian rule which is established will be in an untenable position. And so we first need to move to take action against the oil companies. When we can impress upon them the importance of supporting democratic ideals, when we can impress upon them that the life of a single Nigerian is just as important as the life of anyone who belongs to that oil company, then perhaps we can have some confidence that as we move to civilian rule, the people of Nigeria will have some justice.
Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, any final words? We have a listenership around the country that tends to be very active, and I bet people will want to do something right near now when they hear about this possibility that Congress might move on oil corporations. What would you suggest would be most helpful?
Well, I think it's very important to keep building support for the people of Nigeria, and there's a number of ways to do it. We're certainly going to be taking the lead in the Congress and organizing in the Congress, and it would help to contact your member of Congress to indicate to them your concern over this. Tell them to support the effort at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Tell them to support a congressional investigation of Chevron's activities. And we'll be circulating a letter in the Congress. Ask them to sign our letter on this issue, which will be going to a number of different federal departments, including state and justice. This is just the beginning, but people need to know that something can be done about this. We do not have to accept this conduct of Chevron, which really gives corporate responsibility a bad name and creates new demands on all activists in this country to stand up and speak out on behalf of the people of Nigeria who are being not only discriminated against, but who are being murdered simply because they're standing for their basic human rights. And, we cannot be so addicted to oil that we are ready to give up human rights, because if we do that in any nation in the world, then we can't protect our own rights here in the United States.
And I'd also recommend that people educate themselves on this issue.
Yes.
Human Rights Watch just put out an excellent report called The Price of Oil, and it focuses on the oil companies, what they're doing in Nigeria, and has incident after incident where the oil companies have relied on the Nigerian military to sweep demonstrators away from their facilities, often resulting in many deaths and injuries. It really is a superb piece of research. It's quite chilling to read, and it's available at, from Human Rights Watch. They're in New York City. They also have a website, too, which is very straightforward, www.hrw, for Human Rights Watch, .org.
And I should add that actually Human Rights Watch just received a letter from Chevron Corporation in Nigeria saying they will no longer, that's the Chevron Corporation, answer any questions of Human Rights Watch. One last question to Dennis Kucinich, Congressmember of Ohio. George Kirkland, the American head of Chevron Nigeria Limited in Lagos, if you were to have hearings, would you be calling him back to testify? Also, Ken Durr, who is the head of Chevron Corporation overall based in San Francisco. There was a protest recently in front of San Francisco headquarters. Hundreds of people were there, as well as some Nigerian activists. And they demanded to know not only since they had learned from the documentary that Chevron had authorized in May the call to bring in the military and had facilitated their transport through Chevron-leased helicopters, they wanted to know who in Chevron management actually had authorized that call. Are these the kind of questions you would be asking?
One of the reasons why it's necessary to have a congressional investigation is to be able to fix the responsibility within the Chevron Corporation and to find out if the order came from the United States Chevron headquarters, or if the order originated from U.S. nationals who are working in Nigeria on behalf of Chevron. I think it's really important that we fix some responsibility here, and I think there'll be a lot of interest in the Congress on the issue of moving forward to find out about the responsibility. This is not going to go away. Ken Saro-Wiwa, when he stood before that Nigerian military-appointed tribunal, said that we all stand before history, and that is something we need to keep in mind here. And he urged people to stand up and fight fearlessly and peacefully for their rights. And that's what needs to be done. People need to stand up, and they need to fight fearlessly and peacefully for their rights. And human rights demand that people not be subject to extrajudicial executions in order to satisfy the interest of these oil companies. So I'm going to persist in this, and I'm to me it's a sacred responsibility, and I appreciate the work which is being done by those who are trying to make shareholders aware of the activities. We need to unite as people across the country in support of the people of Nigeria who are just trying to survive.
In fact, when we were in Nigeria, we did get a chance to go to Ken Saro-Wiwa's village and interview his parents. Hundreds of Ogoni greeted us as they talked about the oil giant Shell and Ken's battle against it. One Ogoni man actually recited to us Ken Saro-Wiwa's last words before the military tribunal that executed him.
In my innocence of the four charge I face here, in my utter conviction, I call upon the Ogoni people, the peoples of the Niger Delta, and the oppressed any minorities of Nigeria to stand up now and fight fearlessly and peacefully for their rights. History is on their side. God is on their side. Bene Ogoni.
Sitam, sitam, ya Ogoni, sitam. Ile hira, panyo, wea, ziyai.
And with those words of Ogoni activist Ken Sarawiwa, recited by another Ogoni man this past summer when we were in Nigeria, we're going to wrap up this segment. One more time, Simon Billinis, if you can let people know how they can reach the Securities and Exchange Commission, which will be deciding any day now on the Chevron shareholder resolution that would hold Chevron responsible for its actions in Nigeria.
People can call up the Securities and Exchange Commission at area code 202-942-4150. That's 202-942-4150. Their website is quite simply www.sec.gov. And send a letter to the chairman of the SEC, Arthur Levitt, and specifically urge them to ensure that the shareholder resolution on Nigeria at Chevron this year stays on the company's ballot.
Simon Billinis of Franklin Research, a socially responsible investment group in Boston, thank you for joining us, as well as Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. And we'll certainly keep our listeners updated about the decision the Securities and Exchange Commission makes about the Chevron shareholder resolution. And we'll continue to follow developments in Congress over a possible hearing into oil corporations' behavior in Nigeria. And if you'd like to order a cassette copy of the Democracy Now! Documentary on Chevron in Nigeria, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230.
Who kills our Wiwa? For oil money. Who kills my nation? For oil money.
Chevron, just like Shell, uses the military to protect its oil activities.
The policy for all embassies overseas to support American companies and their operations abroad and to, as far as possible, promote American exports.
Don't pollute my water. Don't destroy our mangrove forests. Don't devastate our ecology. They drill and they kill.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere.
Drilling and killing. Chevron and Nigeria's oil dictatorship.
An investigative report produced by Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill.
Again, you can get that report by calling the Pacifica Archives and ordering a cassette at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Or you can hear the documentary on the web at www.pacifica.org. Just scroll down our homepage until you hit the icon that says Voices of the Nigerian Resistance. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
As we continue,
as we continue on the growing student movement against sweatshops, right now students at the University of Wisconsin-Madison are pushing the chancellor to amend a proposed code designed to eliminate sweatshops and factories that manufacture university apparel under collegiate licensing company contracts. We're joined by the general counsel of Collegiate Licensing Company, CLC. His name is Bruce Siegel, as well as students from around the country. Vanessa Waldriff, a freshman, joins us from Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C. Eric Bracken is from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where students are still sitting in. And Tico Almeida is with us from North Carolina. Duke University just finished its protest 2 weekends ago.
I wear garments touched by hands from all over the world. 35% cotton, 65% polyester. The journey begins in Central America in the cotton fields of El Salvador. In a province soaked in blood, pesticide sprayed workers toil in a broiling sun, pulling cotton for $2 a day. Then we move on up to another rung, Cargill. A top 40 trading conglomerate takes the cotton through the Panama Canal. Up the eastern seaboard, coming to the U.S. of A for the first time. In South Carolina, at the Burlington Mills, joins a shipment of polyester filament courtesy of the New Jersey Petrochemical Mills of DuPont. DuPont strands of filament begins in the South American country of Venezuela, where oil riggers bring up oil from the earth for $6 a day.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we do continue with the sweatshop story, our guests joining us now, Eric Bracken, senior at the University of Wisconsin, Tico Almeida, senior at Duke University and part of Duke Students Against Sweatshops, Vanessa Walriff, vice president of Georgetown Solidarity Committee, and Bruce Siegel, vice president and general counsel of the Collegiate Licensing Company, which has contracts with 160 universities nationwide to produce official university apparel. Well, as I said, students across the country are raising their voices against sweatshop labor practices. A series of protests on college campuses has forced administrations to review how they contract out their official apparel products. The University of Wisconsin-Madison students have been staging a sit-in since Monday evening, protesting a proposed apparel licensing code designed to eliminate sweatshops and factories that manufacture university apparel under the Collegiate Licensing Company contract, saying the code doesn't go far enough. The students are pressing Chancellor David Ward to add three conditions to the code: full disclosure of factory locations, mandatory living wage, and a clear concern for the rights of women workers. Similar protests taking place at Georgetown and Duke. They ended when the university administrators agreed to some of the students' demands. More protests are being planned at college campuses across the country. I got a chance to speak with all of our guests last night, just after the Wisconsin students met with the chancellor. And I began with Bruce Siegel, the vice president and general counsel of the Collegiate Licensing Company, to explain how the company and a code of conduct work.
Well, we've had a pretty consistent criticism of the code since probably last spring, as we knew it was being drafted and saw a few of the first initial drafts. But we pretty much made the same criticisms that, number one, there needs to be, for an strong and enforceable code, you need full public disclosure of all the names, addresses, locations, contact information of all the factories which are making my UW Bucky Badger clothing. Secondly, that we need to make a strong commitment to paying wages, living wages, which meet workers' most basic needs, and this is one of the most essential. You know, one of the things that we know is one of the biggest atrocities in sweatshop labor is that people are making pennies per hour. Thirdly, we've criticized the code that it doesn't have any strong provisions for women's rights protection. We know that the vast majority of the women or the workers who are making our clothing are women, young women, younger than me, mostly in countries around the world. And a lot of times in factories we'll find that these women are, in order to work, are forced to go on birth control. If they get pregnant, they are fired, or they are not hired on the basis of that. A lot of times, they are not paid the same wages as their fellow male workers in the factory. So these are the basic criticisms we've made of the code, and we find that we are at an impasse with the University of Wisconsin, in that it will not commit on the front end to really ensuring that when we sign on to the code, that there will be living wage provisions, women's rights provisions, and really strong full public disclosure.
Well, let me ask Bruce Siegel of Collegiate Licensing Company, what about this idea of making available to the universities the names, the addresses of the actual factories that make the clothes around the country, and then also the issue of a living wage?
Well, we think those are both important issues. The problem that we find ourselves in, and the dilemma that this has placed us in, is that taking the disclosure issue, I think that no one is taking a position that that the information about factory locations should be known by no one other than the licensees, the licensed manufacturers. The manufacturers have taken the position with us that they believe that if all of their different factory locations were the locations of those were made available to the public, including their competitors, they would be potentially losing what they would consider and have identified as a trade secret, and information that, if made known to the public and to their competitors, could put them at a competitive disadvantage. And I'm not arguing the merits of the legal merits of whether and to what extent this information is trade secret. The point is that it has been identified as such by manufacturers, and they believe that some of this information is proprietary, and there are legal consequences involved if we were to be directly involved in having this information be made known to the public. I guess our issue with disclosure is that the question is to whom should the information be disclosed? We think that factory information should be disclosed to the monitors, and that we should have effective and credible monitoring companies that would be involved in going out to the different factories to verify compliance with the university code of conduct.
Tico Almeida, can you respond to the general counsel of Collegiate Licensing Company, Bruce Siegel, talking about having independent monitoring companies go in to investigate factories that make clothes with your logo, Duke's logo, on it?
Right. Well, I think Mr. Siegel is making things a little bit more complicated than they need to be. Perhaps the easiest and most effective way to monitor will be when students and administrators can have access to all the factories which make our clothing, and then we can pass that on to any and every human rights group, international umbrella groups and local groups in specific countries that can go to a factory gate, interview a worker, and then report back to Mr. Siegel's official monitors when there is a violation. At that point, the official monitor that represents the CLC in the university can go, verify that there is a problem, and then set forward a corrective action plan. So really, this is an excuse on the part of the companies because they don't want to be they don't want that much accountability placed on them. They don't want human rights groups to be able to find their factory gates, interview workers, and then raise the red flag when there's a problem. They don't want to be held that accountable, so they've come up with this excuse, which the CLC has bought. But luckily, my administrators haven't, the ones at Wisconsin haven't, the ones at Georgetown haven't. These are the three schools that have taken the lead and said, we see this as an excuse, we see this as a way to try and get away from accountability. We don't buy it, and we're going to go with public disclosure anyway. So I'm glad that these three universities have taken the leadership on this. They've seen past the excuse of the licensees, and they're prepared to make information available to students. And we are very prepared to publicize that information, to get it to international human rights groups, and to get it to local human rights groups for the purpose of increasing the credibility of monitoring, increasing the extensiveness of monitoring, and making the overall implementation of this code as effective as possible.
What is the deal that you struck at Duke University between the protesters and the university? I mean, if the Collegiate Licensing Company has not yet required the companies that work with them to provide the products to the universities, if they're not requiring them to reveal where the factories are, how can Duke find out?
Right. Well, all along, our administrators have been saying that the CLC code is flawed. And in fact, my president, President Cohen, issued a statement that said that the lack of public disclosure from the CLC was a personal disappointment. So all along, they've been with us in principle, but they were not really willing to take a firm stand on the issue. And that's what we accomplished during the sit-in. As a result of that 31-hour sit-in, President Cohen has agreed that Duke University will take a stand on disclosure, and she's agreed that over the next year, Duke and other universities like now Georgetown and Wisconsin will try and lobby the CLC and lobby the other universities to add full public disclosure into the CLC code. But if they cannot do that within a year, Duke has several options, one of which is pulling out of the CLC, publicly criticizing them for running a flawed and secretive process, and then finding a new licensing group, or finding a new code of conduct that is completely transparent and has full public disclosure, or as a last resort, running its licensing independently in a completely transparent manner. So there are plenty of options for the eventual showdown next year, but our hope really is that it never comes to that. We hope that these three universities, Duke, Georgetown, and Wisconsin, will be able to persuade all the others and persuade Bruce Siegel that a secretive process is incredible. A secretive process is easily corrupted, and a secretive process will not improve conditions in these factories. What we need is transparency, and hopefully they'll be able to convince the entire CLC to upgrade its code and fix those flaws.
Bruce Siegel, your response, General Counsel of Collegiate Licensing Company.
Well, I think that TICO overstates or suggests that there's some sort of a contentious process going on between CLC and Duke and some of these other institutions. I mean, we have been working hand in hand, and Duke has been very much a part of the process that we have been involved in, and we're very much a part of the process that Duke has been involved in. And, you know, whether or not I'm convinced of the legal merits of licensees protecting their factories or as trade secrets or not, you know, really is not particularly of import to the situation. I mean, CLC's position in this all along has been that what we're trying to do is be an agent for change in a positive way, and we're trying to work with universities, and we work with many different universities, not all of whom share the same views as Duke does about what it takes and the importance of this full disclosure.
What about, Mr. Siegel, what about this issue of living wage? How can you guarantee through your corporate code of conduct that the companies you contract with are paying the workers a living wage wherever the clothes are made?
Well, the code, the language in the code, and you interrupted me as I was trying to explain that it's, you know, one misconception here is that there is not a CLC code per se. The code or the draft that is in its current state is one that was the result of a collaboration of about 14 different universities, and it's not as though we mandated this code or we set forth this code, but it's really the result of schools trying to get together and come up with a code that will be as strong as possible and widely accepted and capable of being implemented at the licensed manufacturer level. It's on the living wage issue, we believe that is a great ideal. We're just not sure how to get there. And, you know, to the extent that someone can credibly define what is a living wage and have it be a standard that can be passed on to licensees who would in turn ensure that not only their workers but workers in factories across the world could be insured a living wage. That's an issue that we're committed to continue to study, but today we want to get started somewhere, and given that there is just not a concrete definition and way to evaluate what would be a living wage and how that would translate to the worker level, what we're trying to do is begin to raise pay by defining an acceptable wage for purposes of the code is one that is either the minimum wage or the prevailing industry wage, whichever would be the greatest of those two, to make sure that, you know, that we're pushing in the direction of raising wages, but, you know, find it difficult to state as a matter of requirement in a contract that a living wage has to be paid when it's difficult to define what that would mean.
Well, Bruce Siegel, I want to bring in the last student, and she is Vanessa Waldorf, a freshman at Georgetown University here in Washington, D.C., and they have just finished their protest and sit-in. Vanessa, what are your thoughts on how you determine a living wage? But first, can you tell us the settlement that you reached with Georgetown, because you've just finished your protest?
Yes, we finished our protest about 12:30 in the morning, Monday night, Tuesday morning, and we actually did not address the living, well, we had hoped to address the living wage, but our primary goal was to obtain full disclosure, full public disclosure for all students and faculty and administration of Georgetown University, and that is the goal that we did achieve. Our thoughts on the living wage is definitely that full disclosure is the first step to living wage, because then we can find out what the true, like, situations are in the factories. But some ideas that we have about the living wage is that it's so necessary because governments of developing nations intentionally set their minimum wages below what they admit to be what is necessary to meet the most basic sustenance needs. And they do this in order to attract foreign investment. And so this makes the insistence on minimum wage not acceptable, because cost of living which is only like the basic human rights of food, shelter, clothing, medicine. And although the code like states that these wages are to be promoted, there's no commitment or process in place to ensure that adequate wages based upon cost of living analysis will ever be a requirement.
So at this point at Georgetown, you have been able to push through the issue of full disclosure, but what does that mean? I mean, again, if the collegiate licensing company has not committed to that, what does it mean to say that Georgetown has committed to that?
In our agreement, Georgetown maintains that in 1 year, regardless of CLCs complying with full public disclosure, Georgetown will find all the locations, addresses of the factories and outside of the CLC and contact the manufacturers directly.
Back to Eric Bracken at the University of Wisconsin, where you're still sitting in, having just met with your chancellor. Bruce Siegel of Collegiate Licensing Company said, how do you really determine a living wage, and that is an issue at this point that has not been resolved?
Mr. Siegel is right in that this is a very complicated issue, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to deal with it. What needs to happen is universities need to devote resources and time and energy to doing wage studies, and we need to be comparing the difference between those legal and prevailing wages, which the CLC is content with, and the wage that will allow a worker to meet the basic needs for their family. So I think what the CLC task force and what the university should be doing is determining what, defining basic needs, perhaps coming up with broad categories like food, adequate food, shelter, clothing, education, medicine. Then contacting human rights groups that have knowledge of the specific areas in which our factories are located and having them get more specific and telling us, you know, what exactly is the traditional content of meals and the traditional cost of clothing and school fees and shelter and all that kind of thing. And I think it will be difficult, but it is very possible that within a reasonable amount of time, we could do enough research where we can determine that differential between the legal minimum wages and the wage that is needed to meet basic needs. And we're not talking about a lot here. This could be the difference of, you know, 9 cents an hour and 14 cents an hour. That's pennies to the companies, that's pennies to the universities, and it's pennies to the consumer. But that's a huge difference for the woman who can't, you know, buy enough milk for her kids or who can't pay the school fees to send her kids to school. And I think all the research that we do, if we finally decide to implement that research and demand that our licensees pay those wages, all of that research and all that work will be well worthwhile for the woman who finally can work with dignity, who finally has a job, but it's a job that pays her enough to meet those most basic needs of her family.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Our guests have been Tico Amida, senior at Duke University, part of Duke Students Against Sweatshops, Eric Bracken, senior at the University of Wisconsin, chair of Associated Students of Madison, Vanessa Walriff, who is vice president of Georgetown Solidarity Committee, and Bruce Siegel, vice president and general counsel of the Collegiate Licensing Company, which has contracts with 160 universities nationwide to produce official university apparel. If you'd like to get in touch with the Anti-Sweatshop Coalition, you can call 608-265-4276. That's 608-265-4276. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion. A very happy birthday to Maria. Also, Stephanie, Donnie, and Joe Gill is our engineer. Errol Maitland, engineered from New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this is Radio Nation, a progressive review of news, politics, and culture.